From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The story that won't die got a new lease on life yet again Monday.
I know you just said a minute ago you're not going to make any additional statement, but there's a history, and we have been asked by you and others at the podium to respect the statements you make there. So there's a long history of blanket denials during the transition and during times of this administration about nobody within the campaign having any meetings under any circumstances at all with Russian officials.
That was a reporter at Monday's White House press conference grilling White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
And now one was disclosed this weekend. The original characterization of that meeting was amended within 24 hours when new information was placed before Don Jr. How are we to take all of these blanket denials that have occurred through the transition and now when it has been proven and recognized by the president's attorney and Don Jr. that those blanket denials were not factual?
It's become a familiar story here in the U.S. Putin did it. Russia did it. Putin, Putin, Putin. Russia, Russia, Russia. RT's Caleb Maupin took out his pencil and started to do what the experts recommend. Connect the dots.
You've been watching mainstream American television lately. You've probably noticed a recurring theme.
Former CIA chief John Brennan is connecting the dots between Russia and WikiLeaks.
A lot of connect the dots information.
You said the dots that connect.
It's the dots that get connected back with Russia.
Connect the dots. Russia did it.
It's a game of connect the dots. First, find something that you do not like, and then somehow blame Russia for it. And we're not just talking about Hillary Clinton losing her guaranteed presidency back in 2016. Are you a fan of Donald Trump's energy dominance plan? If you are, then the environmentalists who are protesting against fracking, a controversial shale drilling technique, are part of a Kremlin conspiracy.
If you connect the dots, it is clear that Russia is funding U.S. environmental groups in an effort to suppress our domestic oil and gas industry, specifically hydraulic fracking.
And on the other hand, if you're an environmentalist, don't you know that Putin is the mastermind behind the controversial Keystone Pipeline? Are you worried about the alt-right, white nationalism, right-wing extremism? And on top of that, the Occupy Wall Street protests can be traced all the way back to Russia's secret security services.
Who also move and give two practical examples of how the Russians have been engaged in our political system. One was an anti-fracking campaign that the Russians seemed to be engaged in. Another one was the Occupy Wall Street movement that the Russians were engaged in as well.
Sure, the financial crisis, low wages, income inequality had nothing to do with it. We all know that people were protesting back in 2011 because they got orders from Moscow, right? And if public trust in the mainstream media is shrinking, it's because someone is feeding them fake and false information. Guess who?
What about false information, the real fake news being put out by Russians, Russian propagandists, Russian operatives?
Well, that's certainly possible and is well within their in their bag of tricks is something they might try to do.
Russia has become the world's scapegoat for everything, and it's this weird witch hunt that, like, now if something doesn't go someone's way and in international business or in elections or whatever, the automatic finger pointing goes to Russia. I guess it's just the automatic excuse now, especially with this fracking story in particular. Like, okay, they're saying now that Russia is involved with empowering environmentalists to stop fracking. It just doesn't make sense.
So from hacking to fracking, it's all because of the Kremlin. Whenever something goes wrong, you can always say that the Russians did it. It never seems to get old. Caleb Maupin, RT, New York.
Meanwhile, Russia hasn't been standing still. Its foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, met on Tuesday with the EU's foreign minister, Federica Mogherini. They held a press conference together when they were done.
First of all, I would like to thank you, Sergei, for this visit. to Brussels, an official bilateral visit to the European Union that was missing for many years. That follows my visit to Moscow in April and several exchanges we had at the margins of different meetings we had around the world. We regularly discuss especially international issues that involve the engagement both of the Russian Federation and the European Union. And it is clear we do not share the same positions on everything, but our dialogue is constant and it's important. It is essential from our perspective to engage, to cooperate wherever it is possible. And on many of the crises we have exchanged on today, we indeed identified ground for cooperation. First of all, on Syria, we welcomed the announced agreement on the ceasefire in the southwest of Syria that I also discussed with the Jordanian foreign minister yesterday and with Staffan de Mistura earlier today. We see this as a first step towards a broader nationwide ceasefire and a political solution to the crisis. I believe we agree on the need to find a political solution through the Geneva talks, UN-led Geneva talks, and we discussed ways in which the European Union can further support this process as it is implemented. We shared views and identified possible areas of cooperation also regarding the situation in Libya, the tensions around the Gulf. We reiterated our common engagement and commitment to the work on the Middle East peace process in the quartet and based on the two-state solution and our common work to have full implementation of the Iran nuclear deal. I should have said continued full implementation of the Iran nuclear deal. We also discussed the situation in the Western Balkans and further away tensions in the Korean Peninsula, all areas where we can cooperate with certain reciprocal understanding. We discussed also the situation in the east of Ukraine and in Crimea. For the European Union, it is essential the full implementation of the Minsk agreement. We also discussed some of bilateral issues, and I had the opportunity to raise also some of our concerns when it comes to some policies concerning civil society and human rights in Russia. We agreed to increase the level of contacts between our people. The European Union is ready to build bridges when it comes to links between our societies. And finally, we agreed to increase the level of and the rhythm of exchanges at all different levels on the main foreign policy issues we discussed today. Thank you.
Minister Lavrov.
Спасибо. Ну, прежде всего, хочу...
Once Federica found out that I was invited to Belgium for a bilateral program, she immediately invited me, and I was happy to accept her invitation.
И я целиком разделяю то, что сейчас было сказано о необходимости регулярных контактов.
And I totally agree with Federica here on the need to foster our bilateral contacts.
Особенно в ситуации, когда наши коллеги из Евросоюза заморозили по известным причинам, хотя я считаю абсолютно недальновидно, большинство диалоговых механизмов, которые существовали между Россией и Брюсселем.
Especially in the context where our EU colleagues have frozen all of the well-known contact that used to exist between our entities, and I must point out that, to my mind, it is a very short-term strategy.
Но тем не менее связи сохраняются, есть обоюдное понимание, что в любом случае мы соседи, и нам нужно вопросы, которые возникают между нами, решать на основе обоюдного согласия.
And nevertheless, we have agreed that we still remain neighbors, and all issues that arise needs to be solved mutually.
Я думаю, что постепенно ситуация вернется в нормальное русло.
My opinion is that gradually the situation will be fixed.
Это отвечает коренным очищенным от каких-то наслоений интересам и России, и стран Европейского Союза.
And it corresponds to vital and non-politicized interests of both Russia and the EU.
Мы также сегодня говорили о нашем взаимодействии на международной арене. Мы понимаем стремление Евросоюза играть собственную роль в подходах к различным кризисам.
On top of that, we have also discussed the avenues of our mutual cooperation on the international agenda. We totally understand the EU's ambitions to play its own role in solving international issues.
Мы приветствуем такое желание, такой настрой наших коллег из Евросоюза.
We welcome such willingness and vision on behalf from our colleagues from the EU.
И по большинству международных проблем, о которых Федерика только что упомянула, у нас есть обоюдный интерес обмениваться мнениями, вести диалог и стараться найти какие-то практические шаги, которые будут помогать урегулировать тот или иной кризис.
And on most of the items of the international agenda that Federica mentioned, we agreed that we need to find convergent points, the ways to share information, the way to forward a dialogue, and the ways to find a solution from the existing situations.
Так что я удовлетворен сегодняшним разговором. Благодарю еще раз Федерику и ее коллег за очень хорошие консультации.
So mostly I'm satisfied with today's dialogue, and once again I'm thankful to Federica and her colleagues for today's constructive dialogue.
Thank you very much. We will take a couple of questions. The first one goes to the gentleman over there. Please introduce yourself and the media you work.
Thank you. A question for Ms. Mogherini in English, if I may. My name is Ilya Petrenko, RT International. Ms. Mogherini, we have witnessed an agreement on an initiative for a ceasefire in Syria by Russia and the U.S. This, along with the talks in Astana by Russia, Turkey, and Iran, is a direct action towards initiating peace in the war-torn country. In April, the EU made it clear once again that there is no future for Bashar al-Assad in Syria. But is this the only input by the EU when it comes to initiating peace process in the country, or are there any other tangible, concrete solutions that you may offer and be committed to? Thank you.
The European Union, first of all, provides close to 9 billion euros,
almost 10 now,
to Syrians, inside Syria and outside Syria in the region. We're not only a humanitarian player, but we are the ones that are delivering food, medical aid massively to Syrians. This is not just a humanitarian support. This is also a way of supporting Syrians in their desire for a normal life and for peace. We are not a military player in Syria. We decided not to be, and if I can add, we are even proud not being one. But what we can do, and we are doing day by day more, is using the support we can give politically but also financially to the political process based on military agreements. In Astana, there is a clear military process ongoing, and we welcome the agreement reached on the de-escalation zones. We believe that on that basis, needs to follow a political agreement. And I discussed this with Staffan de Mistura, that is leading talks in Geneva in these days. That is the support the European Union is giving and is ready to give more. Because as this ceasefire or the de-escalation zones will be implemented, and we hope, inshallah, that will be soon and well, the European Union is ready to come in with all its strength, financial, political, organizational, diplomatic, and so on and so forth, convening power, to support the going back to normal life inside Syria. Because building peace requires a ceasefire, but then requires also building the living conditions of communities. And here is where the European Union will bring its power of peace.
There's still no future for Assad. Let him translate.
Я хочу сказать вот на эту тему.
I would like to give a brief comment on this topic. So we all know, we are all aware of the big contribution that the EU is making to alleviate the suffering of the Syrian people. But I believe it is high time to consider the humanitarian effects of the sanctions imposed by the EU and the US.
Мы уже обсуждали с нашими коллегами эту, я считаю, ненормальную ситуацию.
We have already discussed this with our colleagues, and I believe that this situation is extraordinary because these sanctions have an impact on vital items, including pharmaceutical products, and the pharmaceutical industry has always been well developed in Syria, but now it has been aborted as a result of the sanctions imposed by our colleagues from the EU and the US.
Что касается вопроса о российской дипломатической...
In reply to your question about the Russian real estate in the US, I must say that we are closely following the situation. We are starting this issue, and we are still hopeful that the US, as a proponent of the rule of law, will finally respect the international obligations. If this is not the case, if they decide not, if Washington decides not to solve this issue, we will have to take counter actions, and this is the rule of diplomacy, of reciprocity. That's the rule of the international affairs.
Just Lauren. To be clear, none of our sanctions on Syria affect civilian population.
They're all targeted to individuals that hold specific responsibilities in the war.
Lawrence.
Lawrence Norman of the Wall Street Journal. A question for both of you. So Foreign Minister Lavrov, can you be clear, will Russia expel 30 U.S. diplomats and seize U.S. U.S. state property, and when will it do it? And a question for the high rep, which perhaps Mr. Lavrov will also weigh in on. You mentioned the complete implementation of the Iranian nuclear accord. A White House spokeswoman said yesterday that Trump pressed fellow G20 leaders last weekend to stop doing any business with states supporting terrorism, especially, and I'm quoting, Iran. Is that a violation of the Iranian nuclear deal? And what is the response of the EU and Russia to those comments?
Well, my answer is very easy. You should have recorded my answer to the previous question, and I invite you to listen to it again.
I think I did listen to it, Minister. Can you just be clear? Is this happening?
I answered your question.
On Iran, I simply reply with the numbers of trade and investments that from the European Union have increased to Iran in terms of double digits, and this will continue. We see a security interest to not only fully implement the nuclear deal, but also engage with Iran. And we see also, obviously, an economic interest on the European side. We will make sure, I think together, but particularly personally, as someone that has a responsibility to ensure that the deal is fully implemented, and also as the European Union that is united on this, we will ensure that engagement with Iran will continue and that the deal will be implemented in all its parts by all. This means the nuclear part, this means also all the rest, like the lifting of sanctions, as you know, and the re-engagement, gradual re-engagement in all sectors. This is something that the European Union is doing, member states are doing, and we are committed to continue to do it. I know that in the United States there is a review ongoing. We respect it, but we have also the duty to make it clear. The nuclear deal doesn't belong to one country, it belongs to the international community, to the United Nations system. It was endorsed by the UN Security Council with a resolution, and I think we share responsibility to make sure that this continues to be implemented fully by all.
Don't translate, everybody understood the question. Yeah. I'm serious.
Okay, then with that, we have to...
Many times.
I'm afraid we don't have time for more questions, so I will have to conclude the press point. I thank you very much for coming.
This past weekend, the Saturday Free School in Philadelphia, which is moderated by Professor Anthony Montero, a frequent commentator here, held an event commemorating the life and work of author James Baldwin. The most recent commentary from imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal talks about one of America's greatest intellects.
James Arthur Baldwin, word warrior. He was born in Harlem Hospital, New York, August 2nd, 1924. Oddly enough, the same year that my mother was born in the South. His name at birth was James Arthur Jones, to a mother blessed with the gift of fertility, and to a father he would never know. At the tender age of 3, he would be renamed the gift of a stepfather with the cognomen Baldwin, the name that would resound around the literary and black worlds and continue long after his life was lived. His stepfather fought to teach him the Bible, and for 3 difficult years he acquiesced and became a child preacher, winning souls in Harlem until he could bear it no more. For he knew at the tender age of 12 that he would be a writer, even as he won awards for his word craft in school and read and reread novels such as Uncle Tom's Cabin and A Tale of Two Cities, while he would later write, he rocked a baby in one hand and he cradled a book in the other. His early school teachers recognized his early facility with words and encouraged his writing. He would later write with keen insight and a savage wit about all around him, fellow writers, other books, movies, plays, all became grist for his ever-churning mill. Indeed, he would later eviscerate Uncle Tom's Cabin as much for its poor writing as for its bloodless, vapid telling of a tale that demanded courage and vitality to reflect the deep and abiding horrors of the American slave system and its tortuous aftermath. In an early critical work, Everybody's Protest Novel, reprinted in Notes of a Native Son, Baldwin slashes at Uncle Tom's Cabin, as well as Richard Wright's breakthrough hit, Native Son, damning all such works as unequal to the task, Baldwin writes. They emerge for what they are, a mirror of our confusion, dishonesty, panic, trapped and immobilized in the sunlit prison of the American dream. Finally, the aim of the protest novel becomes something very closely resembling the zeal of those alabaster missionaries to Africa to cover the nakedness of the natives, to hurry them into the pallid arms of Jesus and thence into slavery. This is writing. Baldwin published this book review in the spring 1949 edition of Zero Magazine, and his simmering style brought him work in The Nation, Commentary, The New York Times Book Review, and Harper's. Many of the journals he wrote for are now no longer extant. But that bite, that crackle, that insouciance would mark his writing, especially in his novels, and most especially when he brooked the river of race. As a man of his time, he traveled widely and lived to see life lived in different worlds, under different suns, so to speak. He met Africans abroad, more likely than not in France, and tried to learn from them many of the things which weren't really available to U.S. blacks. For they may look alike or remarkably similar to one another, but how they see and perceive the world is quite different. For one seeks entry into the white state, the other seeks freedom from the white invader. In his essay, Encounter on the Seine, Baldwin notes how Francophone Africans regard the French. The French African comes from a region and a way of life which, at least from the American point of view, is exceedingly primitive, and where exploitation takes a more naked form. In Paris, the African Negro status, conspicuous and subtly inconvenient, is that of a colonial. And he leads here the intangibly precarious life of someone abruptly and recently uprooted. His bitterness is unlike that of his American kinsmen, in that it is not so treacherously likely to be turned against himself. He has, not so many miles away, a homeland to which his relationship, no less than his responsibility, is overwhelmingly clear. His country must be given, or it must seize its freedom. This bitter ambition is shared by his fellow colonials, with whom he has a common language, and whom he has no wish whatever to avoid, without whose sustenance, indeed, he would be almost altogether lost in Paris. By contrast, he reasons, U.S. blacks rush to disaffiliate themselves from other blacks, making them lonely, isolated, and quite lost in such places as Paris. For the U.S. black, who was called Negro during Baldwin's early days, is so profoundly alienated from the lands, languages, and faiths of his fathers, not to mention a keener alienation from the forces in power in the land of his, her birth, that he is, in Baldwin's prescient phrase, written several years before Ralph Ellison's classic work, An Invisible Man, whether in Paris or in Harlem. Baldwin's brilliant observations and analyses reveals an utterly alienated soul, in truth, nowhere at home, able to dwell anywhere, but to find safety, solace, and true community nowhere. But Baldwin, ever striving to be the exception rather than the rule, returned incessantly to Paris, where he could live, work, and play in a way that the U.S. didn't make possible. Baldwin's gift is this relentless truth-telling about Americans, both black and white, who are locked for centuries in a fatal, repellent, loveless, and sometimes loving embrace, each a stranger to the other, each knowing that which is unsaid, but thought deeply of the other. From his earliest critic days to his life as a successful novelist, Baldwin tells uncomfortable truths about what America means and what it does not. His eye is unerring, for he cites true. His tongue rakes the nation of his birth, which, by long centuries practice, hates and fears him and his kind, the habituation of American hatreds long lived. In this hour, in this day of conflict, his insights bear repeating. For although some things have indeed changed, we must scream the naked truth that some things remain the same. Time, it seems, is a mirage, which passes, to be sure, but which replays itself like a temporal Mobius strip, replaying horrors long thought past with new, insidious forms. In his essay, Stranger in the Village, Baldwin foresees the now that we are about to inherit by observing this world is white no longer, and it will never be white again. Could he foresee the rise of a Trump figure who seeks with might and main to make America great again by a mad dash to the 1950s? Perhaps, perhaps not. Maybe this was a vision beyond his sharp ken, but I wouldn't bet on it. He was a man who knew and admired both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. He was hurt by Black Panther Minister of Information Eldridge Cleaver's dismissal of him for his sexual preference. But Baldwin, being Baldwin, surely reflected on the hurt that his reviews gave to Richard Wright, in some ways, an older friend and a mentor. In his later years, hepatitis almost laid him low, but it would be cancer of the esophagus that would return him to his ancestors. His words, his brilliance, his courage remain to nourish new, younger lives, buoyed both by his greatness as by his gayness. James Arthur Baldwin has become an ancestor. Indeed, he has become an immortal. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.